The Barbershop Group provides safe spaces for men to discuss issues of well-being and mental health. The Barbershop Group also serves as a resource to the community, providing consultations and public speakers through partnerships with attorneys, mental health professionals, family agencies, religious institutions, and other advocates. In the near future, the Barbershop Group seeks to renovate dilapidated residential and commercial properties in urban areas to create respite shelters for displaced men. We will also host mentorship retreats and workshops for young men and adults to foster growth through our Iron Sharpening Iron and our Rebuilding Men programs. In addition, we host a weekly podcast covering issues of mental health, homelessness, financial literacy, education, and leadership. If you would like to be a guest on our show, please email us at info@thebarbershopgroup.org. Visit our Facebook page or call 313-585-9948 for more information.
Hello, hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Awesome. We are just waiting for Dr. Silas.
Okay.
Give me 1 second. I'm waiting for Dr. Silas to get on, and we'll be all set. So it just should take him a few minutes, and we will go ahead and conduct the interview.
Okay.
So I'll go ahead and get started now, and he'll jump into it. Hello, everybody. This is Charles with the Barbershop Group. And today we're going to have a discussion, a very, very difficult but needed discussion about mental health and mental wellness in a particular group of men. And it's great to always have people on the show who are directly involved in the Barbershop Group so that the listeners out there can understand one of the reasons why we have put this organization together. I always like to say that it's an organization of guys. It's a group of guys who they've had problems, and they're helping other guys who have had problems. And it's extremely important for the listeners out there to understand that, you're not alone. A lot of people have faced issues, and you're not sitting there on an island by yourself. So one of the things that we know happens is that men are exposed to violence. We are. And I like to say that we're exposed to four different types of violence. We're exposed, especially as black men. I mean, that's what this conversation is about today, is we're going to be speaking from the perspective of African-American men who have had some interaction on various levels with violence. And, one of the things that I like to say is that we face violence in four different ways. We have systemic racism, micro and macroaggressions. Right. We have, black on black crime. We have domestic violence. And a lot of times that domestic violence is where black men are the perpetrators of domestic violence. And then we have violence against our own selves. So those are the four different types of violence that a lot of black men are exposed to in their lives that, a lot of us, we think that we just have become we become desensitized to it, but I no longer believe that we are truly desensitized to that violence. So today, again, I've got two people with me on the line who are working directly with the Barbershop Group. I've got Waheed Abdul-Muhaymin on the line. Waheed, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hello, hello. It's good to have you on. And I also have Dr. Damon Silas out of North Carolina. Dr. Damon, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I'm here.
Awesome. It's great to have both of you guys on. Thank you for taking some time out of your day today to talk about something that's extremely, extremely heavy. And, you know, guys, we will not have time to go through all of the backstory for you all, but we do want to be able to provide some exposure to you guys regarding, you know, black men, violence, and just how this impacts us, what this has really looked like for us in our lives and in the communities. Okay, so I've got Waheed Abdul-Muhaymin on the line, and Waheed is a stylist for us, a motivational speaker. He's also one of the individuals that we look to for some of our sound engineering and things like that with the barbershop group. He's a poet and author, and just a really smooth, classy guy. He also helps us out when it comes to he also helps us out when it comes to getting the right size pants. But okay, and we also have Dr. Damon Silas, and Dr. Damon is a psychotherapist out of North Carolina. He is a public speaker. He is an author. He is also a hip hop aficionado, a dance instructor, and many, many other things. And, you know, he's into traditional therapy and non-traditional therapy, guys. So, both of these guys are fabulous. I'm glad to have them on today, and I'm really honored to have them be a part of what we're doing with the barbershop group day to day. So, guys, you know, you heard me talk about the four different types of violence that black men are exposed to. And I think a lot of times, I think a lot of times we don't even think about it that way. We don't, you know, in our day-to-day lives, we don't go, wait, geez, which type of violence was I just exposed to there? We don't even consider it, right? We just go, there is just something that happened, you know?
Right.
But everybody in this room, everybody in on the show today has experienced a type of violence in their lives, and they've had to really work to address it. And it's not just like we've gotten over it completely, or we experienced it and we're done. We still have stuff that we're going through as a result of that violence, right?
Yeah, every day.
Yeah. I mean, you don't just, I put it on the side over there and I never revisit it or not. No, it's not like that. It's always present. Is always present, and we have to work to deal with this. So, you know, Waheed, I will start with you, man. And, you know, again, I have been, you know, we've been friends for a long time, and we've worked in different capacities together, and now everything is culminating in what we're doing with the barbershop group and beyond. And Waheed, you had a particularly devastating experience with violence in your life that a lot of African American people don't really talk about. So can you just give us a little bit of background, man, on that thing that really transformed your life?
Okay. Real brief. It was 2 days after my 10th birthday. My oldest brother, well, one of my older brothers, was 23 years old at the time, committed suicide. And I had the unfortunate pleasure of finding my brother. And so I didn't understand at the time what was going on. I knew something was wrong because my brothers were crying. I had seen my mother cry before, but something was wrong because my brothers were crying. And it took me 19 years to cry from that incident. I was in college and went to the cemetery with a friend of mine who was visiting her father. And I remember visiting my brother's grave that was across the street from where her father was buried. She had no idea. And I stepped up on that tombstone. And as soon as I stepped up on that tombstone, 19 years of emotions and everything came pouring out. And it was the first time I had dealt with that openly. I'll share this with you real quick. I have an older brother. There's quite a few of us, but I have an older brother that used to train me when I ran track. And one day we were at track practice, and I have a tombstone tattooed on my chest of my brother. And I had my shirt off, and one of the young ladies that was down there asked me about the tattoo. And I told her what it was for. I told her that my brother died. It was my brother. And she said, "What happened?" And at the exact same moment, as if we rehearsed this story, my brother and I both said that he was shot.
Wow.
Neither one of us. And I remember thinking to myself when I said it and he said it, I remember thinking to myself, he's running around telling this lie too.
Mm.
Because for most of us, suicide carries this negative connotation that there was something mentally wrong with the other person.
Yeah.
And so I always hid that, you know, I always felt like that was wrong. And sometimes people just have problems that they deal with and they can't take them anymore. And this is their end result. But it has affected me on multiple levels. I've experienced it again with another friend of mine. And it's just something that I've become passionate about because I know what it did to my family.
Yeah.
I know what it did to my family. And I would hate to see other people's families underlying, you know, being torn apart and being there's that wedge that's dividing all of the family members because nobody wants to talk about the person as if
right.
it's some kind of shame in raise, you know, speaking their name again. So
right.
that's
right.
kind of my experience with suicide.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's heavy, man. Thank you for talking about it. I know that that's not ever easy to have to recant that story, to have to feel the feelings and emotions and have the thoughts, you know, that are associated with that. Dr. Damon, you heard what he say. It took him 19 years to just cry. And I know that, you know, you're a grief counselor. Have you had other individuals come to you with similar experiences where it was just, it took so long to just really feel something like that because of all the shame and everything involved? Have you had that happen?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I was actually talking to a friend of mine who's also a psychologist the other day, and we were just discussing how a lot of people that we end up seeing, they come in and they talk to us about, you know, what their presenting issues are in therapy, and usually for me, like you said, it could be grief, it could be loss, it could be trauma. And they'll tell me, you're the first person I've opened up to. You know, you're the only person I've been able to talk to about regarding this issue. And it continuously and simultaneously, it amazes me that people don't necessarily have somebody to talk to or have you know, the shame has been so strong, or the guilt or whatever it is that has kept them from opening up, it's been so strong that they haven't had the opportunity to talk to somebody. But also it's an honor to sit there and hold that space for them as well. So,
yeah.
Yes, I definitely have seen that.
Got you. Yeah, that's a very, very, you know, interesting thing too, man, because I remember when I was working with younger people in residential treatment, a lot of these individuals were displaced because one of the parents died by suicide. And whether it was died by suicide or an overdose, a drug overdose, right? You know, there was this thought that I can't tell the truth. I can't be completely open about what happened because of the stigma and the shame. But I also
right.
can't be open about it because I don't want to necessarily feel all that stuff. In fact, guess what? That's why I'm doing some of the drugs that I'm doing in the first place.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Is I don't want to feel that
numb
stuff.
It out.
So let's talk about that for a minute, man. Like, you know, you heard me talk about the kids numbing away the pain, but in those 19 years, man, it took for you to just like cry. Did you ever find yourself really numbing the pain?
Well, you know, it was interesting because I, of course, went to a therapist, but for another reason, not because of this. But in the midst of those conversations that I had with her, I started to discover some things with her assistance, of course, that I had developed an OCD. And it was believed that the OCD was my coping mechanism.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my OCD was the symmetry and order. And it was believed that maybe it was me trying to control a situation that I had no control over. And so I found other things to attempt to control. And it would usually happen when I was stressed. When something was displaced, was removed or moved from me or out of the routine. It because I had developed a routine to help me cope with things.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
when that routine was disrupted, then this other thing kicked in. So it became. I mean, I didn't use drugs, but I guess in a sense, I still had a coping mechanism.
Right.
And,
right.
Well, I hid it. I hid a lot of that pain and emotion from people for a long time. It took me. I can't even give you a definite date of when I was able to admit to someone that my brother had committed suicide. I can't even tell you the first time I actually told someone. But there were things such as I couldn't watch. There was a Shawshank Redemption is one of my favorite movies.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the scene where the old man hangs himself. And I couldn't watch that.
Yeah.
And I knew it was television. I knew it wasn't anybody that I knew. But when that particular part of that movie would come on, I would get up, turn my head, start talking through it as if to distract myself. And I would catch myself watching the movie all the time. But whenever that part came on, I would always do one of those. And so I found other ways. I found ways to cope. But what's interesting, I'll say this real quick, is I noticed my family didn't speak my brother's name.
Yeah.
No one in the family would talk about my brother. And I found that interesting, especially, you know, my mom, you know, seeing it was her child, you would think maybe she'd find some kind of solace in that. But she would never say his name. Even if we were having a conversation about him, she would say her son.
Okay.
She would never say Juan. It would always be her
son.
And so I always wondered, and I've never asked my mom, but I always wonder how she felt about that, you know, about what happened and everything. And I've never really asked her. And maybe that's something I might, you know, I might look into with this conversation now. I may ask her one day, how does she feel about what happened? Because I've never known. Yeah, I've never known.
Yeah, that's interesting, man. That's really interesting. You know, Dr. Damon, you know, if a lot of people have not heard the earlier shows, they're not familiar with some of the circumstances that led to you actually getting into the field. But, you know, you also were exposed to violence early in life. You were exposed to violence early in life that really changed your thinking, that colored life for a while for you, and impacted you in ways that have resulted in what you do today. So what violence were you exposed to that really transformed your life?
Sure. So it was my senior year in high school, and my sister, who was 3 years my elder, so her and I were actually really close. My dad was in the military, so we always moved around a lot. And so the common denominator was always myself my sister and my older brother. And, yeah, so my sister and I were really close. And then she went off to New York City to go to school. And it was less than a week before Christmas that year. And we got a knock on the door from the local police department. And come to find out, my sister had been murdered while she was in New York. It was her and her roommate. They were both raped and strangled. And they eventually found the perpetrators. There were two men. Actually, one was there while the roommate was murdered, and then he left in between the time because my sister was out at the time when she was killed. And then when she came back, the other perpetrator killed her. And so that incident, you know, it threw my world for a loop. You know, I had seen things on the news. You know, it's one of those things you just never expect something like that to happen to you and your family. And when it does, there's no manual that says this is what you do and these are the steps that you take to help yourself through it. So I went to college shortly after that, you know, less than a year after that occurred, and I found the counseling center. I had to. You know, because I knew that I was depressed. I knew that I was just in a very dark space. And from that counseling that I received both individual and group counseling. Group counseling I wasn't as much a fan of initially. I kind of went, you know, with some hesitancy and resistance. But I went. And to me, that was so helpful because then I can sit around and listen to other people tell their stories of grief and loss and trauma. And so I didn't feel as alone as I thought I was, because the bottom line is, like, when something like this happens to us, we always feel so alone and isolated.
Right.
So to And so to go to this group grief counseling session, it just really validated what I was feeling. And they acknowledged it, they validated it, and they made it feel like, it made me feel like what I was experiencing was okay and it was normal. It was okay to feel sad. It was okay to smile. It was okay to question whatever it was you were feeling.
Yeah.
So knowing that, knowing how helpful that therapy was for me, that pushed me into the psychology field. Not only that, but I wanted to work with people, with kids who were at risk for going down that same path as those two men who took my sister and her roommate's life. If I could be there to help prevent somebody from impacting somebody else's family the way that ours was, then that was my goal at that time.
Right. I hear you. Yeah, that's a very, very traumatic experience, man, and very unfortunate. For that to have happened. You know, guys, if you all want to learn more about Dr. Damon's experience of growth and pain and all the emotions surrounding that particular event, you are able to purchase his book From Morning to Night on Amazon.com. It's there. I've read the book. It's an awesome read. It's pretty quick, but you know, he shares the story and he talks about that incident in there, and it's riveting to have that happen to someone in your life, but it's also very, very heartwarming for Dr. Damon to be able to share that with all of us, guys. If you will, we're gonna break just for a moment for a word, and we'll be right back to continue the show.
All right.
Hey guys, Riley here. If you're enjoying today's show and would like to hear more, you can gain access to member-only content by going to patreon.com/thebarbershopgroup. We aim to provide as much value as possible to you and the rest of our community, and our listeners play an important role. So if you want more content, or if you're just happy to support our mission and the other men out there, head over to patreon.com/thebarbershopgroup to contribute today.
So, guys, we are back. We're talking with Waheed Abdul-Muhaymin, and we're talking with Dr. Damon Silas about the impact of violence and grief on Black men's lives. And I think that it's important to have the conversation because, you know, we don't realize that we are impacted by violence in four major ways. We are impacted by racism. We are impacted by black-on-black crime. We are impacted by domestic violence, both as offenders and victims, and we are impacted by violence against ourselves. And that's a lot to take in, right, guys? When you think about it that way, you go like, whoa, no wonder, right? But as I said earlier, I don't believe we are desensitized. I think that we do a lot of numbing. We try our best to numb. And if you're trying your best to numb, that's proof in the pudding that you're not truly desensitized. You're trying to desensitize, but guess what? It never really ever works, right? And one of the things that I think about in today's society, at least here in America, is, well, for black men, when it comes to violence, what comes first, the chicken or the egg, right? Because you've got these stereotypes out there that say that black men are violent, right? Or that we are predisposed to violence, but we don't have a real conversation about the reasons why we may be predisposed to the violence. I obviously do not believe that we are inherently violent people. I believe that we have been exposed to violence within our environments. And then obviously, right, you know, there are conversations that we could have about why that violence happens in those environments. But it's right. just to say that's not who we are. If that were who we are, then we wouldn't have the psychological difficulty dealing with it as much. Am I making sense now? You see?
Yeah.
If that were who we are, if that is who we were inherently, then we wouldn't be, you know, dealing with, we wouldn't have drug addictions. We wouldn't be diagnosed with OCD that maybe has something to do with rewriting the script. You know, we wouldn't be in therapy if we're okay with that being who we are. And so that needs to be said for a lot of people. You know, one of the things that I think about, too, is just what happens to the mind when violence and the rumors of violence are perpetuated constantly. Whether that's, you know, us being violent towards other people or just any of it. You turn on the news and it looks like everybody's being violent. Well, Dr. Damon, I want to ask you, what does that do to the mind?
So it creates this perception that, like you said, we as a people are violent, but what it also does is, I mean, and I think there's a little bit of everything that you were saying in there. We do become desensitized to violence when we consistently see all these images of violence, but it also plays to the id. And so the id, if you look at Freud's tripartite way of looking at how we are, the id is about kind of the sexual and violent urges that we have at our base. But I'm going to go a little bit further, and what you were saying is that's not who we are, because who we truly are is love. Who we truly are is light, you know, and we get away from that. We get away from that by seeing all these images. When we're bombarded with these images of violence in the movies and even cartoons and video games, we get away from who we truly are at our nature. And that's what happens when people come into the therapy room is they get tired. They get tired of numbing themselves.
Yeah.
They get tired of hiding from who they know they are at their core.
Yeah.
And so our job is to help them find it and deal. Because when you think about it, people start to numb for a reason. It was helpful at some point in their life. You know, just like Waheed, like you said, it was helpful for you to go on and kind of numb yourself and go through these OCD-like behaviors. It was helpful at some point, but then you get to a stage in life where that no longer serves you. And I think that's what I see a lot with different people, and even when you think about this violence, is people get to the point in life when it just no longer serves them, and you start to I'm starting to see it a lot too in like some of the older hip hop artists, for instance, where maybe in their beginning stages of their albums, they would talk about, you know, violence and self-deprecating, you know, kind of language and this and that. And now as they get older, they're starting to talk about their mental health. They're starting to talk about healing and getting back to who they truly are, because that was just a facade. And we wear the mask. You know, we constantly are wearing these masks to hide who we are. So, yeah, there's a balance of wearing this mask and being, you know, a certain person and then starting to peel away those layers and getting to who you are at your core.
You know, to piggyback off of that, I definitely agree. But what I think what it does for us is it creates the depression, because you become paranoid from the thought of violence, all these different things. And so ultimately, like you say, you get tired, but you become depressed, because it's like everywhere you look, you know, you're viewing someone as a potential threat or harm to you. And eventually the world is that, you know, the world may be out to get you, or there are certain people in a certain group that you feel like, you know, may target you. And so, yeah, you know, you just kind of become tired of viewing people that way. And I think the fear of something happening to you was actually worse than it happening. And so you constantly go through this string of emotions where you may be in a certain part of town and you're thinking this is the, you know, bad part of town, and you're expecting something to happen and it doesn't. And then you go through this part of town again and you're expecting something to happen and it doesn't. And you repeat the cycle over and over again, and it becomes draining.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely see that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I will say thank you for saying that. And on the same side of that, opposite side of the same coin is the anxiety piece. You know, so when you're constantly paranoid and on edge and you're looking over your shoulder, your anxiety and all those stress hormones are going to be constantly running through your body. And our bodies and minds aren't made to handle long-term stress like that. And so it breaks us down. And like you said, so then you have that long-term stress constantly running through your body. But the opposite of that is, okay, now I'm just tired. You know, I don't have energy to even go out and do anything. And now I want to isolate myself and stay in a safe, quote-unquote, safe place, because that feels better to me than going out and worrying about who's going to get me. You know?
Right. Yeah.
Did we lose Charles?
Ooh, I think we did.
I mean, we could roll with this on our own.
yes, it sounds like we did.
I think we did.
But
you know,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, when you think about the traumatic impact that has on one's psyche too. You know, there's the constant, you know, hypervigilance and, you know, seeing all these images, like you can be traumatized just by watching these images. And so you don't necessarily have to be engaged directly in that act or in a violent act, but just to see it, to hear about it with, for instance, social media, you know, and you have these videos that play over and over again of people getting attacked or people being violated in some way or another. It creates this vicarious trauma. So you don't necessarily have to be directly involved with an act of violence to experience it as a traumatic event.
So do you, I'll ask this question and kind of asking, you know, for myself, but for everyone else as well. So how early would you recommend, you know, potentially black men seeking therapy or some, you know, something along that vein of talking to someone about the things that they've experienced?
Mm-hmm. Ideally, I mean, as soon as possible. You know, I actually have several young black men who I see in therapy, and it's usually their parents who say, you know, they've gone through X, Y, and Z. They don't think they need it, but I still want to get them in to see somebody. And just getting them in the door helps to normalize the experience. So then they see it's not like somebody who's, you know, this straight-laced, buttoned-up, you know, person, older person who can't relate to them on some level. It's just about having a conversation, you know, and once they get in the door, it's like, okay, well, therapy is normal. It's not like this weird thing that I have to feel uncomfortable throughout the entire time. So I would say, you know, as soon as you can, or, you know, when just like, as I was saying earlier, with my experience, I knew that I was depressed after losing my sister, and just having that self-awareness to say, you know what, maybe I should go talk to somebody.
Okay.
Yep.
So I'm ask this question then. So what is it that you think we could do to like help normalize these type of conversations?
Talking about it, you know, when you see, you know, like Steve Smith Sr., I think he just put out an article on NFL.com this past week about his depression. There are a lot of different athletes and celebrities recently who have talked about their experiences with anxiety, depression, trauma, et cetera. And the more that we normalize it, the more that we just say, hey, we are humans. We have emotions. Like we're not supposed to push our emotions down. Emotion is short for energy and motion. And so when you push your emotion down, it's like that beach ball that you constantly try to push underneath the water. And what's going to happen is it's going to keep popping back up in some way. And our emotions are the same. The more that So the more that we try to push them down in a way and act like they don't exist, the more that they're going to manifest in some way physically, emotionally, within our relationships, it's going to come up. And so just having those conversations and saying, oh, yeah, like I went through the same thing too. You know, it's interesting. Once you start to open up to people, 99% of the time somebody's going to say either, A, I've been through it and I hear you, or B, I know somebody who's going through that.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in those situations where I wasn't comfortable in speaking at first until someone else said something, and then it was like, oh wow, they're going through that, and then I felt compelled to say, hey, well, you know what? Yes, I've been through that, or you know, I have a friend that experienced that. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Well, you know, because I'm always full of questions, man. So please bear with me.
No, you're good.
I don't know what happened to him, but yeah, we'll keep you know. So, what is it that like you would want the audience to take away from this, like regarding violence, suicide, and grief?
The main point is, you know, from the mental health standpoint, to be proactive. You know, be proactive about your own mental health, and or if you see somebody in your environment who you see is struggling, be proactive about talking to them about whatever is going on. If you see somebody acting aggressively and angrily consistently, and you know that's not who they are, that they have more potential and they have, you know, more love in them, and you know, to be proactive and just pull them aside and say, hey, what's going on? You know, there's always a way to get help. You know, I know a lot of people say I can't afford it, or I can't find somebody who looks like me, or, you know, I just don't want to go. I don't have the time to. There are so many different avenues that you can take to get help. You know, whether it's there's online therapy. You can speak to somebody just over the phone. There are numbers that you can text, and, you know, so, and there are different resources, and I know Charles has a link, or the Barbershop Group page has a link to resources as well. But it's just really about, like, you know, reaching out and taking that first step. And the first step is always the hardest, and I get that. Like, it's always hard to admit vulnerability or to be vulnerable. Mm. It's always hard to say, I need help. But that's who we are. Like, we're not here as islands, as individual islands. We are here to connect with people. And so just the act of doing so helps you, helps your healing process. And I have a question for you, but I'll just say, like, for me, even as a therapist, constantly talking to people on a daily basis, that helps my healing process. It's not just a one-and-done thing, right? It's not just I go to therapy and, you know, it's all about me. It's really about connecting with people who also have gone through something similar and then using what I know to help them grow and get through, not get over, but get through what they're going through. And, well, I'm curious, like, what has your process been like? And, you know, what would you tell the people who are listening in terms of your healing process?
Well, my healing process is an ongoing process. And you had mentioned something a little bit ago about talking about it, having the conversation. As a poet, because I'm generally shy, so I don't talk about things like this. But as a poet, mm-hmm. I hide behind my words. So a lot of times I can express myself better through the poetry as if it's really someone else. So I can almost detach myself from you know, my situation and write it from the perspective of someone else. And really it is me. So a lot of times I do a lot of healing through writings, and it's really the conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, mostly sharing, even with myself. You know, I have conversations. I think about my brother, you know, quite often. You know, I try to stay in contact with his child. He had one child and his granddaughter. You know, I try to communicate as much as I can with them, even, you know, for my own peace of mind, because I feel like I'm still connected, you know, to him. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like the more we don't talk about, you know, him, the more he becomes this distant memory. And he's, you know, he's still a family member. So for me, it's always really trying to keep his memory alive is what it is. In any way that I can. I've named things after him, just so his name is spoken all the time, you know. And some people may not even know why that name is what it is. But for me, I know, and that's what helps. So, for people in general, for people to be more open about how they feel, I have, in my experiences, I've learned that a lot of times that's part of what problems are, is people bottle up their energies, their emotions, the words, and they're going to come out, as you say, the beach ball. They're going to come out one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to deal with them somehow. So it's best to find a, you know, person or a group of people and share and express it with them. So that's my take. I'm looking at my phone and we're probably close. So, behalf of the barbershop group, I'm not sure what happened to our host, but, you know, we handled it for him. But, you know,
absolutely.
You
got to keep it going.
You know, we thank you, Dr. Damon, for, you know, hanging out with us. We thank everybody for listening. And you're welcome. And, you know, have a great weekend, and I guess we'll talk to you and everybody else soon. So until then, have a great weekend.
All right, bye, y'all.
All right.